I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, space tourism. But first, President Bush says he's too busy to watch today's launch of 3 days of historic debate on a sparsely worded House resolution supporting the troops in Iraq but opposing the president's plan to send more. If the president had been listening, he would have heard freshman Democrat Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania, an Iraq War veteran, speak in favor of the resolution.
3 years ago, I came home, but 19 of my fellow paratroopers did not. I rise to give a voice to the hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvanians and veterans across the globe who are deeply troubled by the president's plan to escalate the number of American troops in Iraq.
Democrats have restricted debate so that Republicans can't change the non-binding resolution in any way, and that prompted this from California Republican David Dreyer.
The American people are concerned about this war, and they want to know that their elected officials are developing a sound and effective policy. So what have the Democrats offered us? Their proposal is, in fact, meaningless as legislation, and it is disastrous as a policy.
Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, any surprises today?
I think you'll see a lot of interesting discussion today. I have never seen a debate that is so prepared on both sides. I was just over at the Republican War Room. They have 60 posters prepared and briefing books bulging with comments to rip and read. They have six people helping members instantly respond to claims on the floor. And I think there's as much firepower on the other side. But, you know, in the end, it comes down to individual members. I just spoke to one Republican who said that he really is going to write it himself. He isn't going along with the party's talking points, and that he considers it the most serious speech he may write in his lifetime.
And each member is supposed to speak for 5 minutes over 3 days. So he may not go along with what probably was the party line that we heard from David Dreyer?
He has his own views on it. In particular, he feels that members can't just go along with the war as long as there are troops in the field. We're not potted plants, he said. We have to speak out on this, but in our own time and in our own way.
Well, as we heard, there's two parts to the resolution, to support the troops, but also oppose the surge. This comes as a poll in USA Today shows that a majority of those polled want U.S. troops out of Iraq by the end of 2008. A little more than half want to cap the number of troops in Iraq, but the same number does not want to cut off funds supporting troops. So does this resolution meet their needs?
This is the heart of the issue. There are many Democrats who are concerned about the funding issue and how it's going to play at home, which is why the resolution was so carefully crafted. It includes both a statement that Congress will continue to support and protect members of the armed forces who are serving in Iraq, and that it disapproves of the decision to deploy more than 20,000 additional combat troops. Republicans last night in the Rules Committee tried to get Democrats to agree to split that resolution. That is, we'll vote on the president's surge, but we also want to vote on the support the troops piece, which they are interpreting as a commitment never to cut funding. And that Democrats refuse to do because they don't want it that. They don't want their members having to defend a vote on that.
Well, Democrats are calling this an opening move. In budget hearings next month, anti-war veteran John Murtha is expected to bring up a measure to restrict funding and deployments. Just tell us briefly what his measure will call for.
He's going to raise issues like this. We will not send any troop overseas that has not been adequately trained or equipped, and therefore funding will be diverted to equipment and training. So he's keeping the focus on care of the troops, but at the same time sapping funds that, this is a guess, he hasn't actually come out and done this yet, but this is what he's talking about, sapping funds that could potentially be used to fund the surge.
Right. And diffusing the power of the word cutoff.
Exactly.
Right. Well, Gail Chadwick, as we said, this is going to be going on for 3 days on the first resolution.
Until midnight.
So we will be back with you with more as each House member gets up to speak, as you said, carefully crafted speeches. Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, private business has moved into an area long controlled solely by government, outer space, with airplane flights that simulate weightlessness, spaceships that take tourists now into the ionosphere, and inflatable hotels orbiting the Earth. Companies like Virgin Galactic, the space-era spin-off of Virgin Atlantic, plan to send tourists on suborbital flights in the next 3 years. We want to begin our look today at this new space race with a couple of space tourist pioneers. Pam Hurley-Moser of Hurley Travel in Maine has just completed training at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. She was selected to be one of Virgin's 47 space agents in the U.S. We also have Loretta Whitesides joining us. She and her husband George have delayed their honeymoon until 2009, when they'll be among the first to fly on Virgin Galactic's space plane. Loretta, between you and your husband, you are spending $400,000 on this flight. That's a lot of money. Will it be worth it?
We really see this as an investment in creating a new industry and really fulfilling our dream of making spaceflight available to all people. It's like the people who could buy VCRs, and then the price came down, and now then everyone could buy a VCR.
You're helping the rest of us by, I mean, it's quite noble of you to do that. Are you afraid?
Absolutely. I mean, I've done a lot of adventurous things before, and so I know what it's really like to do something that, where you're really taking your life in your own hands. It's not theoretical. But I think it's worth it. I think we have to be always pushing the frontier if we want to be evolving as a species.
Well, let's describe the trip so people understand why I might have asked that.
The mothership, White Knight, will actually lift off and carry Spaceship 2 underneath its belly up to an altitude of about 50,000 feet. And then Spaceship 1 will drop, and then it'll light its rocket engine, and it'll burn its rocket engine for on the order of 90 seconds and shoot straight up to highest altitude of about 110 kilometers.
And then at that height, what, you'll spend how much time in space?
You get about 7 minutes where you can see the blackness of space and the curvature of the Earth and really get that incredibly awesome view that everybody says you want to write home about.
And how long will you be weightless?
Weightlessness will last on the order of 4 to 5 minutes to float around and just feel completely free of the bonds of gravity.
And will you be floating around? Do you sort of, you know, loosen your seatbelts at that point and float around?
Absolutely. It was definitely one of the design requirements. Virgin Galactic has made it so that the 6 passengers can unbuckle their seatbelt. Their seats will recline so that make extra space in the cabin. The 6 people can float around as much as they like.
Okay, well, that's the trip. Pam, you are one of the people picked from across the country by Virgin Galactic to be an agent to sell this trip. Just in the training, what did you learn?
Well, we basically started at the beginning learning a little bit about rocket science and the principles of space flights, and learned a lot about the technology of the product and the launch systems, safety, medical, G-forces. They have a centrifuge there where you do get to experience what G-forces are like.
We understand going into the centrifuge can make people nauseous. You might black out, have fits.
You know, G-lock is rare.
G-lock, tell us more about what that is.
G-lock is basically when the G-forces are so strong that they're pushing the blood down from your head down against the pumping of your heart. So what happens is you can have blackout or gray out and sometimes go into, you know, convulsions, very much like an epileptic fit. It does not hurt, and you do come out of it unscathed in about 30 minutes. But again, it is very rare. But people do need to understand that this isn't just a commercial airline flight. It is a space flight.
Well, and Loretta, you've had some of this training. What did you do?
I am a flight attendant for Zero Gravity Corporation.
Zero Gravity Corporation. They do weightless flights?
Yeah, we have a 727, and we do parabolic flights just the way NASA trains astronauts, and gives you about 25 seconds of weightlessness at a time.
Right. What does that feel like?
Oh, it's incredible. It's like all the world that you're used to, that you've spent your entire life in, where you, if you put something down, it drops, is just gone, and it's extraordinary just to be able to float around like you've always imagined and dreamed, and it feels like coming home.
Loretta, do you have friends who say to you, you're out of your mind, or this is a pipe dream, this is not going to happen?
There's always going to be naysayers, but I try to surround myself with people who are actually all share the same dream, and we're all working to make this one happen. We feel like barnstormers. The barnstormers of their day didn't really realize the impact that aviation was going to have on the world, and I think that spaceflight's the same way. I think it'll be something that'll have a really big impact somewhere in our future.
And, you know, for those who would say, $200,000, what could you, $400 in your case, because you're going with your husband, think what you could do to the local school system or, you know, something else with that money.
Well, for me, it's about leverage. I mean, what can we do once we've come back from space? We're very dedicated to education and inspiring the next generation, but what better way to inspire them than to go in there and tell them, yeah, we did it. Here was our dream, and here's how we made it real and how we made it happen. Now you guys go out and do the same.
Loretta Whitesides and her husband have signed up to take a suborbital flight on Virgin Galactic's space plane. Pam Hurley-Moser of Hurley Travel just completed training to be one of Virgin's 47 new space agents in the U.S. Thank you both for telling us about this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, so what do you think? Well, for more on space tourism, we turn now to James Oberg. He's a former rocket scientist for NASA. He's written several books about space exploration. He joins us on the line from his home outside Galveston, Texas. And Jim, listening to Pam and Loretta, did they sound naive to you, or is this going to happen?
This is going to happen, and it's going to happen because there are always enough people who are naive to say, just because it hasn't been done before doesn't mean it can never be done.
Do you think ordinary people who maybe have just gone to a little bit of training are going to be able to handle that?
They'll be able to handle it. The question is going to be is how much will they be able to enjoy it? And that's part of the preparation that was mentioned earlier. How do you train people so that their minds don't freeze up? Not just their bodies freezing up, not just G-lock, but how about just eyeball lock? You're going to be seeing things that you've never seen before, experiencing things, feeling things you never in your entire earthbound existence. And most people, when that happens, they just sort of freeze up.
Yeah.
But you only have a few minutes, so they're going to have to be ready to look and see and recognize and test things out and tumble and then get back in the seats in time.
G-lock, as we said, is, you know, what happens to the body when all this pressure hits it at that speed, at that height. By the way, just explain the difference between these suborbital flights that Virgin Galactic is planning and the orbital flights that NASA takes. Why, for instance, won't these planes burn up on reentry?
The flights that are being planned now for the tourists are much like NASA's X-15 rocket plane flights back in the early 60s. And that was carried by an aircraft, launched, went straight up to 80 miles and came back down again, but never went more than 6,000 or 7,000 miles an hour and never did what satellites have to do, which is get high enough, fast enough, and horizontal enough to swing around the Earth continuously to go into orbit. To do that takes at least 100 times the energy and, looking at price tags, more than 100 times the money to buy that kind of ticket. It's a much longer flight. You have to spend days in space instead of minutes, but you pay for it.
What dangers are there?
Any danger at these speeds is that something could happen to the controllability of the space plane. If you start spinning, the ship can tear apart. Now, the space plane is a totally unique design where the wings actually swivel, and the front point of the wings swivel up and down and becomes, on the way down, not a plane, but a shuttlecock. And that shuttlecock automatically keeps its belly straight into the wind. It doesn't even need any positive control, any active control, and is pretty well fail-safe for stability.
Just like in badminton.
Just like in badminton.
Right.
With no one swatting at you.
One would hope. We're talking to Jim Oberg, a former rocket scientist for NASA, about space tourism. Right now, there are at least 20 companies developing space planes, as Virgin Galactic is. And as the number of trips increases, the price is expected to drop from $200,000 to a mere $50,000. When we come back, we'll hear more from Jim about this inflatable space hotel and also the stresses. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about the reality of sending tourists into space with former NASA scientist Jim Oberg. He's been telling us about Virgin Galactic's plans to offer so-called up-down flights. They'd take tourists 60 miles above the Earth to barely kiss the lower fringes of space before quickly coming back down to Earth. Next on the horizon, an inflatable space hotel in which tourists would spend weeks in outer space. Well, Bigelow Aerospace of Las Vegas is already testing a prototype in space. Jim, NASA initially developed this technology and turned it over to Bigelow. Can you explain in layman's terms, how does it work?
The idea that Bigelow Aerospace has is to build a pressurized hull, a pressurized habitat in space that it can lease out to anybody who wants to use it, including, if they like, some hotel chain or a laboratory system or a university, and lease this out. And they can do it cheaper than NASA because the technology has gotten easier and easier and easier to build these structures.
Sounds a little like the snow fort that I just got for my nephew, but it inflates and it. What is it made of, and how does it stay up there?
Well, something goes into orbit and will stay in space if it's several hundred miles above the Earth. It will circle the Earth indefinitely, and if it slows down a bit, you can use small rockets to push it up once in a while. Their plan would be to have something up there the size of a house trailer and visit it with other spacecraft launched around the Earth. Now, getting into orbit is much, much harder than just doing an up-down flight. When I mentioned a factor of 100 in terms of the energy, and 100 in terms of the ticket price, we're talking, what, $200,000 for a ticket price for an up-down flight, but the commonly published ticket price for a ride on a Russian spaceship into Earth orbit is $20 million. Hmm. So there's your factor right there of 100. And that number is not going to come down a whole lot. Bigelow hopes at some point that people can buy orbital tickets for $6 million or so. That's still a whole lot more than the up-down flight, but because you can be there for weeks, and you can be there in a comfortable position, and you can be there in your own private quarters with the greatest view off the planet.
We understand that you'd see the sun rising and setting every 90 minutes.
That's right. People never get tired looking out the window, and plus there's all sorts of things you can do in zero gravity for entertainment and for aesthetics. Just thinking about modern dance, the kind of things or the calisthenics person could do.
It apparently looks like this giant inner tube.
The design looks more like a giant sausage because its skin is multiple layers of Kevlar and strapping and cabling and forms a barrier that's much safer in terms of air leak, in terms of space debris impact, much safer than a tin can.
Still not completely, though, because, you know, nothing is with all the debris flying around in space. I mean, here's a line that caught my eye in some reading. If it got hit, this space hotel, it could deflate and everybody inside would die.
But it's something that's big enough, and these stations, like the International Space Station and the Bigelow structures, are so big that the kind of holes that you could imagine would take a couple hours to leak out. Remember, there was an air leak on the Russian Mir space station. They got hit by one of their own supply ships, and the air was shrieking out of this crack in the side of it.
What's the difference between this inflatable hotel and a space station?
The difference is that if you fold it in so it's only one-third the size when it's launched, and then it expands about three times the size once it's in space. Now, that means you can launch it under a smaller canopy on a rocket, and it's also lighter. So there are many advantages. NASA liked the idea, too, but Congress cut the project off because they thought, in some ways, the project made interplanetary spaceflight too tempting.
Meaning what?
Meaning that this is the way you would build a spaceship to go to Mars.
Ah, and so they don't want to go down that path.
They don't want to go down that path, but someone else is going to.
Is this also another way to cater to the people who have a lot of money? And in that case, how will this also be different from what we think of as a space station? Will there be gourmet meals? Will there be a wait staff? I mean, is that the thinking?
Probably hard to get a wait staff because you're only going to have maybe three or six people on board, and you might have two people are part of the crew and maybe four people are the paying passengers. It's more like maybe a gourmet camp-out trip where you don't have a wait staff, but you're not slumming it either.
And you think it's going to happen?
I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen with these projects or the ones that follow on. And it's going to happen despite the fact that some people are going to get killed doing this.
Yeah. And Jim, before we let you go, you've been speaking quite a bit about Lisa Capote Nowak, who was the astronaut alleged to have wanted to kill a rival for her love interest. Of course, it was a story that was captivating everyone. But I'm just wondering, do you think, as some are saying, perhaps astronauts and people who go on these space trips, tourists, people who are planning on going on trips into outer space, should be monitored more after the trip? Do you think that there is something to her story that tells us something about the impact of space travel?
What it might tell us with the astronauts is that they're particularly focused people. And to many of them, making a space flight is the high point of their lives. The consequent deduction from that is once they've made their space flight, their lives are downhill for the rest of the next 30 years. That's an extremely depressing concept. Buzz Aldrin wrote about that himself in a very courageous book after his return to Earth, and that's the name of his book, Return to Earth, about the load that put on him and his loved ones after he got back from the moon. It's still there. This is still the people still have a letdown after their flights because they concentrate all their activities and they have everyone around them supporting their every whim to help their training go smoother. Once they're past the flight, they not only have a letdown, but they also are nobody. Someone else has the parking spots in front of the building. Someone else has gotten all the staff working for them, and they just pass them in the hall and say, hi, welcome back, and that's it. Mm-hmm. It's one of the greatest letdowns a person can have in their life.
It's perhaps a cautionary tale for civilians who are looking to take these trips that, you know, what goes up must come down.
You can say that, and definitely a good double entendre.
James Oberg, former rocket scientist for NASA, author of several books about space exploration. He's speaking to us about the next, I'm not going to say final frontier, because who knows, space tourism. Jim, thanks so much.
Sure.
Quick note about tomorrow's show. It's Valentine's Day, so we're going to ask the question, do arranged marriages work? We'll take a look at a tradition in many cultures, especially South Asia, that's been imported to the U.S. and moved online. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Bombs packed with metal pellets tore through two commuter buses, killing three in a mainly Christian area of Lebanon today, the day before the second anniversary of the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, and as Hezbollah supporters continue their protest in front of Beirut's main government buildings. Anthony Shadid is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He's in Beirut. And Anthony, we'd planned to talk to you today about Iran to get a sort of reporter's notebook, but as we ask you about this bombing today in Lebanon, are we still talking about Iran? Because we know that Iran backs Hezbollah, the militant Shia party, which is pushing to destabilize the U.S.-backed Lebanese government.
Well, I think it's a good question. I think it's difficult to talk about Lebanon without putting it in the regional context. In some ways, I think people see this as a proxy battle between the United States and Iran for influence not only in Lebanon but the rest of the region as well. There's a lot of speculation today on what was behind this bombing, who was behind this bombing. Most people you talk to in the street at the scene just shrugged their shoulders. There was almost a certain weariness at how far this crisis has gone and how precarious the situation in the country is. But I think on the other hand, people are wondering if the timing wasn't specific. There's a commemoration tomorrow for the anniversary of the death of a former Lebanese prime minister 2 years ago. That's going to bring a lot of government supporters into the streets. In fact, just a few feet away from where Hezbollah is doing their sit-in at the foot of the government headquarters, they're going to be separated by barbed wire, but little else. And there's fear that could erupt into something tomorrow. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of speculation going on in political circles that there is a potential resolution of this crisis nearing, a mediation that's been worked on by both Iran and Saudi Arabia, both of which have allies here in this struggle in Lebanon. Some people have thought this is maybe a message or a way of sending a signal that if all parties haven't agreed, then they can make trouble here. Most people point their finger at Syria, of course. That there's no evidence for that. This is speculation. But the idea that, you know, if all parties haven't agreed to any compromise deal down the road, then the deal is not going to happen.
You write that despite the violence, that government supporters are betting on the restraint of Hezbollah because of a fear of sectarian civil war. Is that with an eye to Iraq?
I think a lot of people are worried where this sectarian divide, the Sunni-Shiite tension, is headed. And I think you often hear, I think the people being most vocal about it, to be honest, these days are Iran and Hezbollah. They've been very, very blunt in warning against this and warning of the dangers that this could bring about. And there's one aspect of it is sincere. They do worry that this could erupt into a civil war with untold consequences for the region. But I think both also see that in a predominantly Sunni Arab region, they have more credibility, they have more legitimacy, they have more sway if the region isn't defined in sheerly sectarian terms. In other words, if Hezbollah is seen as more of an Arab movement, say, than a Shiite movement, its appeal is, of course, going to be broader in the region. Same goes for Iran. If Iran is seen as a Muslim government rather than a Shiite government, it again can have more appeal in a predominantly Sunni world. I think both those parties worry how this is going, and that's why they often will say that they see the United States, they see Egypt, they see Saudi Arabia trying to incite these differences as a way to blunt, say, Iran's influence on one hand or Hezbollah's appeal on the other.
Meanwhile, what is the feeling in Lebanon right now? We've heard that there are signs up in restaurants and other public places, you know, people really trying to keep this sectarian divide at bay, asking people not to talk about politics.
That's right. I think there's a certain weariness that you see in Lebanon today about how long this crisis has gone on and what the crisis is doing to the country. You hear, you know, numbers like tens of thousands of people have left the country since last summer's war, frustrated by the situation that the country's in. And I was struck today when I was up at the scene where these two attacks happened, that often when you ask people who was behind the bombings, they'd often shrug their shoulders. It was almost a gesture of weariness, of how far this crisis has gone and how elusive a solution has been so far.
Well, let's open up your notebook on Iran. There are more questions today about U.S. claims that Iran's government is supplying Iraqi insurgents with these lethal roadside bombs. Today, a top U.S. General Joint Chiefs Chair Peter Pace told reporters in Indonesia there's no evidence of that connection. So what's your sense of what's real and what matters here?
There is a sense, I think, and you often see this in newspaper editorials in the Arab world, that the United States is trying to, in some ways, exaggerate the Iranian role as a way to, as a way to explain the situation that it finds itself in Iraq today. This could be conspiracy theory. It could be just, people talking about, what's on their mind. But you definitely do see that in quite a few editorials here and there.
You also quote a Saudi academic as saying the most important thing about the ascendance of Iran is that it doesn't reflect any change in Iran, but rather a change in the region brought on by this investment in democracy. Another scholar tells you, after this whole investment in democracy, the West is losing, Iran is winning. That's the perception there?
I think it's an interesting point. I think it is very, very widely felt here. Iran's greatest enemies through the 1990s were Iraq, which it fought an 8-year war with, and the Taliban in Afghanistan, which it almost went to war with in the 1990s. You know, two U.S. invasions got rid of both of those regimes, and so in a way it did get rid of Iran's two greatest enemies. Iran finds itself in a much, much better situation, I think, in the region today.
Well, before we let you go, Anthony, you've been holding online chats on WashingtonPost.com, and we've been reading them. We want to ask you about some of the things that people are asking you. They seem very interested in your writing about the Shia-Sunni conflict as a political conflict rather than a religious one. You firmly believe that. Could you explain that?
It'd be wrong to say that the sectarian divide hasn't always existed. And it has colored politics in the Middle East for centuries and centuries, I mean, dating to the very beginning of Islam. And even more recently, when the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979, I think people, this idea of what did Shiite Islam represent became a bigger issue. That sectarian divide has always been there. There's no question about that. But the factors that are contributing to its inflammation today, that are deepening the divide in so many ways, are very political factors. And I think that it's most clearly seen in a place like Egypt. Egypt, which has such a tiny Shiite minority that it's hard to count. It is in some ways becoming the talk of the town. It's the talk on the street right now is, what do the Shiites represent? What do the Shiites mean? What are the Shiites going to do? This is a country that has no contact with Shiites. And I think what we're seeing is a political climate that's becoming conducive to that, a political climate in some ways that, you find a certain level of opportunism. Sunni Arab governments, seeing a way to blunt Iran's influence as a way to strengthen their standing. The United States also seeing the same thing. There are a lot of factors that are leading to this, but I think if we don't define it in political terms, then we miss the dynamism, perhaps, of what's going on right now.
You write that intermarriage, for instance, used to be common in pre-war Iraq, where a question of one's sect was impolite. In Lebanon, a former prime minister converted so that, by law, his daughter would win a better inheritance?
It was a one-day conversion. That's right. It did happen.
So there was, the lines were more blurred, and that was more accepted, and it's been hardened to a degree.
And I think that's what we're seeing here. And in some ways, the most, I think, devastating impact of what this tension is leading to is how it's reshaping the social fabric of these places. And we saw that most dramatically, I think, in Iraq. I mean, in Baghdad, it's a segregated city at this point. That wasn't the case before the war. In Lebanon, these prejudices or stereotypes are being maybe pronounced with a little bit more ardor. In Egypt, we're hearing, almost fabulous stories sometimes about what Shiites do. I mean, it displays a certain misunderstanding of what Shiite Islam actually is. All this stuff is coming, I think it's playing itself out on the social level as much as anything else, and that's where it might have its longest-term impact.
There was a question that jumped out at us from someone in Laurel, Maryland, who asked you, who, if anyone, would be a good, impartial, and respected peace broker who could help quell the Sunni-Shiite strife going on in Iraq right now? Your answer?
I don't know. It's really hard to think of anyone who could step in right now and try to broker a deal.
Anthony Shadid, foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He's speaking to us today from Beirut, just giving us a little of his reporter's notebook. Anthony, we appreciate it. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
And still ahead, a woman from Maine builds a legacy in the Guatemala City dump. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney made it official today in Michigan. Romney formally announced his bid for the Republican Party nomination for president at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan, not far from where he was born, and in the state where his father, George Romney, ran the now-defunct American Motors Company, governed for three terms, and launched his own unsuccessful presidential bid back in 1967.
I chose this site for a number of reasons. It's filled with cars and memories. Dad and I loved cars. Most kids read the sports box scores. Dad and I read automotive news. We came here together, him teaching me about cars that were built way, way before my time. The Rambler automobile that he championed right there was the first American car designed and marketed exclusively for the purpose of economy and mileage. He dubbed it a compact car, and a car that would slay the gas-guzzling dinosaurs. And it transformed the industry.
Well, joining us to talk more about Mitt Romney and his dad is Nolan Finley. Nolan edits the editorial page of the Detroit News. And Nolan, Mitt Romney's dad, George, reigned a while back. Is talking about him going to resonate with people in Michigan?
It will in Michigan. He was governor in the 60s, but he probably remains the most popular governor we ever had, and perhaps one of the most effective. It's a golden name in the state. His mother also was very politically active in this state, and even more so than when he was governor. After he was governor, George Romney and Lenore Romney did a lot for this state in terms of promoting volunteerism, promoting community activism. They just were beloved figures in this state, and I think it is smart for him to invoke that name. And I think whether it gets him any votes or not, I think it's a big part of who he is, that motivation that came from his father's and his mother's ideals in their career.
Well, let's talk about that. Perhaps sending the signal and talking about cars and his dad's transformation of the auto industry, maybe signaling that he hopes to do the same.
Well, I've heard Mitt Romney say on a couple of occasions that his dream job would be to be chairman of General Motors Corporation. I'm not sure that's not a job he couldn't have if he wanted it today. But
And then he has another dream today. But that brings another pitfall in perhaps reminding people of his mother, because he credits his mother, Lenore, at least he did back in 2005, with giving him his sense of abortion rights. Now he's saying that he is anti-abortion, but back then he credited his mom's campaigning. She had an unsuccessful bid for the U.S. Senate, campaigning on a platform that included abortion rights, and he credits her. That's going to remind people that, of course, he changed his mind.
It's going to remind people that this is a very contentious and difficult issue for Republicans. They have to run one way in the primary and then run another way for the general election, and I suspect Mitt Romney has his eyes solely on the Republican primaries with this shift in his abortion position.
Well, and in speaking of his dad, we're reminded of another war. George Romney had to drop his own presidential bid just 3 weeks before the New Hampshire primary, and just after he made televised comments there in Detroit about the war in Vietnam. He'd made a visit to Vietnam as an official in 65, and he said, "I had the greatest brainwashing that anybody can get, and that's why I supported the war." He then went on to say, "I no longer believe that it was necessary for us to get involved in South Vietnam to stop communist aggression in Southeast Asia." Well, he was just pilloried for, you know, saying that he had been brainwashed by military officials.
And how many boys would have been saved had people listened to George Romney in 1968? But I get a sense in many ways that Mitt Romney is motivated very much by the same things that motivated George W. Bush, and that is protecting his father's legacy. There's a sense that George Romney was wronged. George Romney was misinterpreted, and I get, when you listen to Mitt Romney talk about his father, you get a sense that part of what drives him is restoring his father's reputation and legacy.
But in reminding us of his dad, George Romney, who was against the Vietnam War and was considered a moderate Republican, we're reminded that so far Mitt Romney has been very supportive of the Iraq War.
Well, I suspect whoever wins the presidency is going to have to put on the table a much sharper plan than what exists if they hope to sway voters.
Nolan Finley, editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it.
And after the break, a young woman who's the subject of an Oscar-nominated documentary who died way too young, but not before she saved a lot of children in Guatemala. That's next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 36-year-old Hanley Denning of Yarmouth, Maine, went to Guatemala City in 1997 to learn Spanish, to be a better social worker back in America. But she ended up staying in Guatemala because she found her life's calling in the city dump. She found the guajeros, the thousands of adults and children who made a pitiful living picking through garbage, a vicious cycle of generations of squatters living in and off the city's fetid refuse.
What really struck me was just the enormity of it and the overwhelming stench. I mean, I had never smelled anything like it.
Hanley called her parents back home in Maine and told them to sell her possessions. In 1999, with the $5,000 they raised, she founded an organization called Camino Seguro, or Safe Passage, an educational center for children of the dump. Her work was featured in the film Recycled Life, which was nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short in January. But just 5 days before the nominations were announced, Hanley was killed in a car accident. Her work continues, as we'll hear. Ellie Friedland is assistant professor of early childhood education at Hanley's alma mater, Wheelock College. Students from Wheelock now travel to visit the center, and Ellie joins us in the studio, and I can see this is very hard for you.
I was fine until I heard her voice. I haven't really adjusted to the fact that I can't talk about Hanley in the present.
Yeah. This is so sudden, so new. Tell us about this young woman. I mean, with $5,000, she's grown this organization to what?
I believe it has a budget of $1.6 million now, right, in 6 years.
And it went from 40 kids to 600. Paint us a picture of life at this dump that she encountered.
You can actually see layers. It's sort of like an archaeological dig, and you
right.
can see the layers. It's many, many, many years of garbage.
Building, you know, several stories high.
You can tell how big it is because there are these huge garbage trucks that come in, and they look like little matchbox toys.
Right.
And one of the things that you'll see is these trucks drive way into the dump, and then 40 or 50 people run over to the truck and put their hands on the sides of the truck, and they are claiming what gets dumped from that truck.
And then you see them raking through, climbing through the garbage. Now, the children are not there in the dump with them now because of recent regulations put in place by Guatemala City. But when Hanley first started, they are sleeping in the garbage, sleeping in boxes, pawing through it, some of them orphans without any parents, and the dump comes to them. The garbage is in their homes.
They're also, it's important to know, sneaking in because they still need to work to survive. So even though children officially aren't allowed in the dump,
right,
they are still there.
Well, the attempt at banning kids came after a huge fire in the dump in 2005. It was set off by methane gases, and it set off an outcry, and the city got more involved. But Hanley Denning was there years before, as we said, in 97. She noticed that dump kids couldn't get into schools because they couldn't afford the fees and the uniforms, and that's why she first set up Camino Seguro as a place for them to go. Then she got the schools to take her kids in. Then she raised the money to pay for their uniforms and fees. So they go to school. So now the center is what? Sort of a whole family outreach?
All families are very closely involved. If a child doesn't come to Camino Seguro or a child doesn't go to school, the social workers are out looking for the children.
And educating the mothers in particular is so important because this might be the third generation of the dump. They don't know anything else.
It's virtually impossible to get out of the dump once a family is in it. The only route out of the dump is education.
Right. And by the way, we know that there are garbage pickers at dumps in other countries as well. But this is the one Hanley focused on. Here she is in the film Recycled Life, talking about the people that she works with. Let's listen.
And I think it's very important for all of us to remember that there is a real dignity there and that the people are proud. They work very hard and they've overcome enormous obstacles. And in spite of working in the garbage dump, they are very proud.
The program works because Hanley and everybody who works there is a full part of the community. And there is no sign of were the smart Americans coming in to fix you up, or noblesse oblige, or disrespect. It is completely respectful, and families have to give to the program. This is not a handout program.
Just to see the change in the documentary from the children a few years ago, and then in the special DVD edition that has a tribute to Hanley, to see the change in the families is remarkable in just a couple of years. But what impact has she had on the students from Wheelock who have been going to volunteer?
They all say it was utterly life-changing. Several of them, and actually some of their friends who weren't even there, are talking about the year they graduate volunteering for at least a year at Camino Seguro. One of them, a social work student, was very adamant, and she's very clear when she talks about this now, that she went very skeptical and really actively searched for problems with the program. And she's actually the one who, at Hanley's memorial service that we had at Wheelock, the one who spoke of her as an angel. Mm. It's that total.
That's Ellie Friedland of Wheelock College here in Massachusetts talking about the Wheelock grad who came to be known, as she said, as the angel of the garbage dump, Hanley Denning. Hanley created Camino Seguro, a refuge for the kids who lived in refuse in the Guatemala City dump. Hanley was killed in a car accident last month at the age of 36. Well, as we heard, Camino Seguro, or Safe Passage, has been embraced by other Wheelock College kids, but it's grown into a huge million-dollar nonprofit. Who's going to keep it going? We turn now to Rachel Main, a worker at Camino Seguro. Rachel, Hanley Denning was such a force. In addition to missing her, do Guatemalans there worry that with her gone, the center's, you know, going to go too?
Yeah, the last week or so, we had the board of directors down here and Ed Mahoney, the acting director, and myself just reaffirming that this work is continuing and we still have lots of plans ahead. We have the high school that we're planning. So for them to see that there's still these visions and, you know, this isn't going to stop, so...
But Rachel, a difficult question. As you know, the school that started in a tiny church has grown bigger, not a school, but as an enrichment center, you know, has grown bigger as you have plans for high school kids. You know, some people might say, isn't this, you know, just sort of enabling this garbage dump culture? Is there any sense of encouraging the city to create some situation so people don't have to live and work at the dump?
The government here, unfortunately, doesn't have the funding to support some of those social programs. That's really where we step in, and our vision is both to be giving these children the education, but also the life skills and the practical skills to be able to become self-sufficient. It really goes back to their families. They want to do it to be able to help their family.
In fact, we see an illustration of that in the tribute. There are children that I'm thinking probably met her when they were 6, 7, 8 years old, and they're 14, 15 now, and they're saying, they were in these really sad images of her funeral, and
yeah,
they're saying, I'm going to make sure I make her proud.
Definitely, and one of my worries was when I came down here for Hanley's funeral, of just seeing how torn apart the children were that have been with her from the beginning, and my worry was, you know, what if they drop out at this point? And coming down here now this week, it's just so incredible, just the pride that they're carrying along with them, and it's almost an extra effort that they're putting in to really, you know, make Hanley proud and make their families proud and their country proud and show that, you know, they can do it.
Well, Rachel Main, this must be very difficult for you, so thank you for speaking with us about it.
Thank you so much.
One last note, Camino Seguro is supported by people who sponsor a child. Here are some of Hanley Denning's last words in the DVD about her life.
Oh, if I could have something tomorrow morning to help our program, I'd want 1,000 new sponsors.
To find out more about Camino Seguro or about the film Recycled Life, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.